Friends, will you join me in prayer? Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable to you, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. As Susan reminded us, throughout the Gospels, the disciples of Jesus have power problems. They tussle over who is the most important of Jesus' disciples, who's the closest to the inner circle, who's going to be Jesus' second in command, and today they're at it again. Just before this, they were involved in this kind of skirmish with collectors of the temple tax. Should Jesus and his disciples financially support the temple? Jesus answers in a way that compares himself to a king, and his disciples to the king's children. So you can see why they might now be wondering, little princes that they are, who is the greatest in Jesus' kingdom, the kingdom of heaven? And as usual, Jesus sort of has to gently put them in their place. Truly, I tell you, unless you convert and become like a child, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. For added emphasis, he takes an actual child and sets them down in the center of the circle as a kind of sermon illustration. We may be in the bit of a habit of romanticizing teachings like this about children. You may have heard that Jesus is calling the disciples to innocence or trust or receptivity, the kind we see in children. Just as children fully embrace their parents without question or compromise, we too must act as children in our faith. As it is, Jesus is calling us to change something internal in our disposition, from wanting to be the best to being content in our faith. Like little children, we can become obedient and docile to God. Who here has ever lived with a child? Has anyone here been a child? Just a few people? Anybody work with the children on a regular basis as a pediatrician? Those experiences may let the air out of the tires of this sort of romanticized reading of what Jesus says. So instead of emulating sort of character traits of children, Jesus may have something else in mind. He brings attention to children because of their social rank, where they fall in the hierarchy of Roman society. And that place is at the very, very, very bottom. In the Greco-Roman culture of Jesus' day, childhood was largely associated with negativity, of immaturity and smallness and vulnerability. All of these are characteristics that are the opposite of an ideal Roman citizen. Children speak nonsense, adults speak intellect. Children are foolish, adults are rational. Children live in the moment, adults plan ahead. The Roman philosopher Cicero wrote explicitly how there is nothing good about reverting to childhood when we are adults. I'll just add that if you know any adults, these positive grown-up characterizations are also largely untrue, but that's... So, children is incomplete and less than ideal. It translates in Roman society into how children are treated. If you were a father in a Greco-Roman culture, you had absolute and total authority over your child. Children had no rights and no recourse. Roman law details brutal practices towards children and the extent to which fathers control the lives of their children. One writer says, to imprison, to scourge, to put him in chains, and to keep him at work in the fields, or even to put him to death. This power extends to a father's right to recognize a newborn as his own, or to leave that baby out for exposure. Girl babies were especially vulnerable to this practice of exposure, and they might get picked up by strangers and raised for profit as sex workers or slaves or beggars, or they might just die. And so it's in this social world that Jesus makes this jaw-dropping claim. Unless you turn around and become like a child, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus then goes on to say that children sort of highlight this bigger group called the little ones. These little ones show up in all sorts of ways in Jesus' ministry, in beggars and the enslaved and widows and children. Little ones, they're this group that is the most vulnerable in Roman society. And even though I'm describing practices from 2 millennia ago, children in many parts of the world, even in our own country, they are not that far from this reality. When I was an undergrad, I studied in Kenya, and outside the college, I met a little girl. She was 8 or 9 years old, and she spent her days hauling water between a public tap at the college to her small village about 10 kilometers away. And as I got to know her a little bit, my Kiswahili got better and was able to understand more. I learned her story. She was from a family in the city with many, many children, and she'd been given, or perhaps sold, to an uncle for labor just to carry water all day. She is among millions of children who labor in sweatshops and factories, who don't receive schooling or government protections. When they are no longer able to work, they're discarded. But even in wealthy countries, places like here in North America, children share a common characteristic with children in the ancient world. The value of children rests on what they will become, not in who they are. Roman children were considered valuable on the basis of their future social standing. Would she become a good citizen? Would she become a good wife? Would their daughter increase the family's social standing through an advantageous marriage or a land transfer? Would the son increase the profile of the family? And we can actually see this attitude in our own time. Bonnie Miller McLemore, who's a scholar of the theology of children, calls this the market-driven eclipse of children as gift. She writes about our narcissistically hungry society that treats children as an extension of their parents' worth. We see this when children's success becomes a form of sort of parental self-affirmation. And in our capitalist economy, children are first and foremost consumers to be marketed, advertised, and sold to. Ironically, at the same time, the market has no patience for the unproductive and unsettled nature of childhood, especially poor children who really have no economic value. And all of that brings us back to the disciples and to us here in this room. Jesus' words are stark. We are to be converted to children. The question posed by the disciples, this feud over status, it's actually incompatible with the reign of God that's established through Jesus giving up his life. There just cannot be power games here. To show us how serious he is, just after this conversation, Jesus has one of the most frightening judgments of his ministry. He still has this child in his midst, and he tells the disciples, "If any of you cause one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be good for them to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and drowned in the deepest sea." What is the stumbling that Jesus is talking about? Well, as we're reading across the story from the beginning with this tussle over power, Jesus seems to mean the fight over status that played out between his followers. This is the sort of thing that makes people stop believing in who God is. What good is this Jesus to those at the bottom of social society if the church just recreates the same structures of power that deemed these people worthless? The disciples, in their arguing, they are in a unique position to squelch trust that the poor place in God's care for them. As it is, our church, Jesus Church, is a place where power plays and that cannot exist with power plays, that's ordered around those at the bottom of our social order. And what that means is that each of us is welcome not just for our potential, not just for what we might be or what we could contribute, but for who you are right now. It is true that Jesus brings the disciples' attention to children as a representative of this group called the little ones. But I also don't want that to distract us specifically from children and the role that they play in the lives of Christians. There are practical ways that looks at our church. Honoring children is why we have a safe church policy, a policy that's built around the extreme vulnerability of children and the need for us to be vigilant in their care. We honor children by not treating them like tiny adults, but creating opportunities and spaces for them in worship that help them stretch out their whole selves. One of the people I turn to when I think about honoring children is the Presbyterian pastor and children's television creator, Mr. Fred Rogers. So for some of the younger people in our lives, you likely know Mr. Rogers through Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. In many of the interviews and tributes to Mr. Rogers after his death in 2003, I noticed the same word being used over and over again. Dignity. Dignity. Mr. Rogers took seriously the experiences of children, from the sorrow over a dead goldfish to wondering about how Black and white people live together in a racialized world. And as we've been exploring yieldedness to God's will over the past few weeks and a few more ahead, I've been reflecting on the shared commitment to dignity of children for both Mr. Rogers and Jesus. Jesus tells his disciples to convert to children, but Mr. Rogers shows us what that might look like. Every week on his television program, Mr. Rogers offered the same blessing. It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair, but it's you I like. The way you are right now, the way down deep inside you. I suspect that the disciples, not unlike us who are surviving a world of competition and social hierarchy and survival of the fittest, that maybe we're also longing to hear those words. Our desire for status to lift ourselves above others, that doesn't show up in the reign of God. And that's because there's a different story, a deeper story that's true here. It's a story that children and grownups, that all of us long to hear. You are known and loved just as you are. Amen.